everybody. You'll tell me, those of you who were here last week, you'll tell me if you learned something either the same, parallel, different than what I'm about to say about the same Mishnah that you might have looked at and where you started. But I couldn't stay away from one of the essential Mishnayot myself, of the chapter that sets forth a lot of what has come down through the ages has been a relational kind of conceptual framework or relational framework to otherness and the outside world and non-Jews. And for Shabbat, when we talk about Shabbat, to Shabbos Goy. This is one of these spots in the Gemara, and not so much Gemara about it, but one of the spots in the Gemara where it's introduced. I may not go into it in as much depth as you might have done last week. I heard a little bit from Rabbi Zalma. I want to go into the next Mishnah and all of the fascinating conversation in the Gemara about the next Mishnah as well, so we can really do Daf Kuf Kaf Aleph today, both side A and side B. That's my goal. And we'll push forward. And there's some interesting pieces about how the Mishnah itself is made, though, on 121a2, if you're in the Schottenstein edition. So we'll start with the Mishnah there, and then we'll look at the Mishnayot as they appear in two of the popular Hebrew-English Mishnah works, one from Kahati and one from Blackman. And we'll talk about the differences that we see there. But this Mishnah deals with the reaction to others and, of course, the fire that breaks out on the Sabbath and what one may do or may not do to extinguish it or in hopes that one will not suffer too big a loss, what one may do. So it says, in our defus, in our printing of the Gemara, Nochri Shebalechabot, a Gentile who comes to extinguish, and that is a fire that breaks out on the Sabbath. It says, Ein Omrim Lo Kabe. You don't say to him, Kabe, extinguish this fire. And Ve'al Techabe, nor do they have the right to tell him, don't extinguish it. Hi there. Are you here for Talmud?
Yeah.
Welcome. So we're seeing that the Mishnah is relating to a non-Jewish soul who's out there and who is obviously fully aware of this fire and you can neither say put it out and you can't say va'al techabe or don't put it out. Two sides. So Rashi says about the following, Ein omrim lo kabe, you don't say to him, put it out. Rabbanan gazura al amira l'nochri mishum shavut. That the rabbis, the sages, made laws, decrees, concerning the statements we make to non-Jews because a person is commanded to have shavut, to allow his or her possessions to entirely rest, let's say, or to not transgress any kind of mitzvot, either ase or lo tase, positive commandments or negative commandments, with one's belongings, or regarding one's belongings. Velo tichabe. So, why do you say don't put them out? Mivnesha ein shivita to alehen, because his resting, his allowing his belongings to rest, and his allowing himself to refrain from all manners of work, that's not the same in regards to the non-Jewish person. This soul who's come into the picture has not the same obligation as this owner of the household himself. So in regards to his coming and putting out a fire, I neither say to him, go put it out. I don't say to him, don't put it out. I let things unfold. So why do I just let things unfold? Let's hold that out as a question. So the next part, aval katan sheba lechabot, but a minor who comes to extinguish the fire, ein shomin lo, they don't allow him to do so. And in this case, shomin is, they don't teach him that it's permissible. You've heard the term in the Gemara used before in Mishnaic parlance, shema'ata. A shema'ata is a teaching. And in this case, it's not. They don't listen to him as in, I want to put it out, I want to put it out. You know, we don't hear you. It is, they don't teach him, they don't instruct him that it's permissible. Davka mivnesha shvitato alehen, because his resting is their responsibility. Because his Sabbath observance is in fact a requirement if he's a member of the community. And therefore we understand that katan is a halachic category and it's just talking about a Jewish child. So that's a phrase that we'll see time and again in rabbinic literature, that a katan is a minor, and a minor is someone who either can or cannot follow the law, do according to our tradition. And there are unique principled approaches in regards to a youth when it comes to the teaching of the law. And so the Mishnah is ripe with all kinds of scenarios here and all kinds of relationships we have that, of course, talk to the very central premise of having a fire on the Sabbath.
Is a minor someone below bar mitzvah?
Yeah, at this point, straightforwardly, a minor is someone below bar mitzvah.
That means a Jewish child is coming to put the fire out, and we don't tell them, don't do it.
No, we do tell them.
We don't tell them, do it, or we don't tell them anything.
No, we do tell them not to do it.
We tell them not to do it.
Mm-hmm.
The reason he's coming is because the child is under bar mitzvah. He's not bar mitzvah, he doesn't need to follow the Shabbat law in general. He can do whatever he wants, so that's why the
point is. Let's say we didn't tell him lo techaveh.
That's nochri.
The non-Jewish person who comes, your neighbor who's a non-Jew,
okay.
You don't tell him extinguish it or don't extinguish it.
Yeah. It doesn't say we tell the child don't extinguish.
Correct, but
we don't teach him to extinguish.
Yeah, but we don't even allow him. In other words, the way that it's said here, it's an interesting question. If you're only reading the Mishnah and saying what the Mishnah says in the positive, you could find that and make a diuk. You could ask the question on the Mishnah. Wait a minute, we don't shomin lo. If we take the word to listen to him, or if we take the word even to teach him, we don't teach him to do that, but meanwhile, while we say we don't teach him to do it, you're proposing that he could very well go into the house and throw a half-wet goat skin, like from the last time we got together and we saw
the
Mishnah. Right, we're comparing the language. On the other hand, what the Mishnah is doing perforce is it's saying, it's not even a matter with a katan of saying do extinguish it or don't extinguish it. It's saying about a katan, we don't teach that it's permissible at all. And that why? And that we have a reason for it. Why? Because our obligation to teach him the whole concept of shvut, of letting lie all these possessions, of not transgressing neither positive nor negative commandments, this is our responsibility as a community. All right? So in regards...
Yeah. Why do we have to assume it's a Jewish child?
Because the Mishnah uses the term katan to describe such a child.
So assuming then if it's a non-Jewish child, we have the same rules as an adult?
Yeah.
A non-Jewish adult?
Right. That's, well, we could imagine that, right? We could ask the question. Well, what if you talk about a minor non-Jewish child? The Mishnah hasn't related to that. So I really shouldn't propose that the Mishnah is going to say the exact same thing about it, because I don't really know what the sages might have said. But it's definitely referring to a Jewish child here. Especially because the Shavuot is on him.
Nochri, wouldn't that pertain to somebody of any age?
Well, that's the question. Are there differences between minors in the world of Nochri, in the world of non-Jews, or is everybody just a Nochri, whatever their age? There's a ben Nochri, there's the child of a Nochri, and in a few situations we'll relate to Na'ar, the youth. So.
No, I thought that it would apply because a katan in Jewish tradition, the bar mitzvah age is the age at which you assume commandments. So a responsibility for both. And so since Nochri don't have the same commandments, is it not the need to distinguish between young
Nochri
and an older and mature.
Okay, so maybe there's not the need to distinguish. But what's interesting, the most interesting thing for me right now, Roberta, in terms of what you're saying, and that's a fine thought, and it's definitely that we do these kinds of parsing out, you know, maybe we do need the category, maybe we don't need the category, and this is for the sages to tell us, and sometimes the category comes and sometimes it doesn't. But here's what I want to point out about what Roberta just said. I heard Roberta use the word Nochri. I didn't hear Nochri. But you're right. There is another word for someone who's not Jewish, and that's a Nochri.
Right.
That's a Christian.
Right. Right.
Right. Right. What other word might I have thought of? Forget what you know from the Mishnah or Talmud for a second. If I said to you, Nochri, Sheba Lechabot, a non-Jew who comes to put out the fire. What other word could I use for Nochri?
Goy.
So, Goy, in its proper term, used non-disparagingly, indeed is a term that I might expect for the texts to present, because in our parlance around the Jewish world, the term Goy has become a term associated with a single person of non-Jewish persuasion who we have some type of relationship with, be it positive or negative at any given time, right? That's goy. Except, just for having in the interest of having all the language of the Mishnah in front of us and the possibilities of the language in front of us, it's very interesting that in rabbinic literature is the first time that the term goy is used to note an individual of an other nation, and that it's a development from the biblical use of the term, which presents goy as any nation, including us. And so it's very, very interesting philologically and in the sense of rabbinic parlance and the words we use for nations and for people, that we have this term, and it's made quite a progression, if you will. So in an article that's written as part of the Shalom Hartman Institute's think tank of looking at our modern Hebrew, looking at biblical Hebrew, looking at rabbinic Hebrew, I want to tell you about some of the progress or the progression of this term. Very interesting. I don't know if you were here last week. Was this part of the discussion? It's as the Mishnah goes, it doesn't say goy and it doesn't say notzri. Notzri is a later, because post-rabbinic you have a real Christendom come along and notzri become the way we understand those who are Christian. And what do we do with this term goy? So the concept of the goy divides humanity into a binary manner, say these two scholars, Rosenzweig and Adi Ophir. Adi Ophir had done some of the initial look and work with these terms. The most important of these, we argue below, though, of other ways to conceive of the whole notion of goy and Jew, is that the Jew and the Gentile together with God indicate a unique triad in the Bible. The Jew, though, being one of the goyim. So that every goy has its cultural reality, its religious reality, and this goy, the Am Yisrael goy, is an Am that has to take responsibility to do a code of holiness, to behave and ritualistically do things that God says are holy. That is very different than being an Am Kadosh. A goy kadosh even. A holy nation. So the Tanaim in the Mishnah and in Tanaitic literature, which we have all over for making up the Brisas that we see in the Gemara, they are the ones who are particularized the Jew as goy and did not call the Jew as such, but gave that name to all other nations. Goyim. And Avi Weiss used to give a talk, and he once came to L.A., and he stood up in front of the Kahal, the world of L.A. Judaism, and he said, it's so interesting, we have Orthodox, Conservative, Reconstructionist, Humanistic, Modern Orthodox, now Open Orthodox, now, you know, this kind of Jew, that kind of Hasid, Orthodox, Hasid Vilna, Hasid Visionist, Hasid Chabad, who's not exactly for them, this, and the rest of the world. Goyim. You'd think we had this huge population. But this history is very interesting, and goes on to say a little bit that psychologists and sociologists remind us that every identity is based on difference, and points out that this category of goy is looked at as progression to get to a place where it is the lumping together of all non-Jews into one category, and the separation ensued in terms of binary reality of Am Yisrael or Goy Kadosh and Goy and then Am Kadosh and then Goy, holy nation or holy people and other, through what happens in the Bible. And if you look at the Bible as a long kind of sense of historical texts in and of themselves, then Goy in the Tanakh means nothing more than this nation until in Sefer Daniel, which is dated as the latest, that's Daniel, and in that book, it's where Goy began to denote the specifically foreign nation, but it's a nation, and the Tanaim are the ones who make it about an individual, just by way of the background of the term. That leads to other texts, outside texts. Remember the ones we're not allowed to save from the fire and we should just let them burn? That leads to outside texts, Ben Sira, the Damascus Covenant in terms of the Dead Sea Scrolls, as referencing Goy as a nation, whereas Tanaitic literature references Goy as a single non-Jew. So the leap from Daniel to the Tanaitic literature says that Goy now is the single solitary non-Jew. But of course, sometimes it's not used. What's used in its place? Or what's used? Nochri. Nochri is also a term that was used in the Bible. In the Bible, it connotes a general sense of strangeness. In Proverbs, the word is used time and again to say something other than, zar. And if you look at the Evan Shoshan, which is a definitive kind of dictionary, like we have the Oxford English Dictionary, so the Evan Shoshan Dictionary is the core and Ur dictionary of the Hebrew language today, and this is the student's edition that has the, you know, the very basics that are part of the philological historical entries in the 7-volume version of this dictionary, and there's also a 4-volume version that you can get that has some of the information. Nochri is translated as, first entry, zar, foreigner. But then, interestingly, it wants to take a verse from Shemot and says, ger hayiti ba'eretz nochriya. Ger hayiti. To say that ger is kind of along the lines of a nochri, so they, and also the word ger, which is this kind of foreigner, a little bit different than the nochri, because the ger within the Bible, you wouldn't say could substitute in for the language we have in our Mishnah nochri. Excuse me, because ger already has a lot more commandments to do in the Bible than a nochri. A nochri has no commandments. A nochri is an absolute foreigner. And it only makes sense that nochri is used in the Mishnah for the times that we say we're talking about people who are absolutely outside the boundaries. Because we wouldn't want to say about a ger who has some responsibilities according to different literature, even when it comes to Shabbat. We wouldn't want to say that there's any other term as possible. Except that we thought Goy might be possible because over time the Tanaim convince us that Goy can be used for the single non-Jew. But that doesn't happen right away. So the Mishnah has to use the term Nochri and not Goy. Because it's only developing during this time period. The notion that Nochri has this force of being a term to use for someone who has no place within the legislative body of Jewish legislators, within the legal framework, is brought out already in Shemot in Exodus, where the term is used to say that the Nochri does not have the right or the same claim or the kind of standing in the Jewish legal context, whatever, if we had a court or we didn't have a court, that time is debatable. But we already see the term strongly used. So it's fine and it's good that it's there. It makes sense in the history of our terminology. We don't see Goy in any manuscript. So it's not like we can think of them as interchangeable, and so I bring that to say it was a good thought, but it's not exactly what we find. And there's yet one more term, where is this, that we do find, or actually two in this case, being that this is a kind of Ur text and one of the great places of relating to non-Jews in the world of the Mishnah. We have to kind of ask, what were the rabbis thinking of them as? And what kind of language connection did they make? So take a look with me at this, which is two copies of the Mishnah. If you take one and pass it along, please. So these are two copies of the Mishnah, one being from, again, Kahati. Remember, Kahati is our friend, the banker, who loved the Mishnah so much that he sat at his job in the bank, and in between transactions, wrote an entire commentary to the Mishnah based in Talmudic literature, and uses the Vilna edition. And this is Blackman, for the English-speaking public, one of the first English translations of the Mishnah that came out on Judaica Press, a nice you know, it was first marketed, I think, you know, for the walls of a synagogue and for maybe a bar mitzvah gift, if, you know, you wanted to get a bar mitzvah translation. So anyway, the first side with the number one on it is the Mishnah from the Kahati, and he's using the Mishnah that is found. He's using the Mishnah that's found in our Gemara. Nochri shebal chabot ein omrin lo, a nochri that comes to put out the fire. But turn over the page, and Blackman, who likes to show you that it's on side my number two on the bottom. You can see the number two on the bottom of that page. He likes to show you that he's done a little bit of work in looking at manuscripts, and here's how you tell, because it doesn't say nochri. What does it say? It says Oved Gilulim, not found very often at all in even some of the other manuscripts that say Ovde Kochavim. And Oved Kochavim, if you look at note 1 on his page 73, he says Oved Kochavim in some editions as that little note, because he's telling you about this opening clause of our Mishnah that it's Oved Gilulim, and some say Oved Kochavim. What is an Oved Gilulim?
By the way, Gilulim is the manure of horses. So maybe this guy was collecting
That's
a
modern.
So what's an Oved Gilulim?
A pagan.
And an Oved Kochavim is what? Pretty much we either think it's Zoroastrianism with the great powers of in the sky of good and evil, or it's star worshippers. And those who see the gods as being represented in the stars. Different than, again, we've had this discussion before about looking at the skies and reading it. Very different. It is people who see them as gods up above. Now, he makes it seem like the word Nochri is non-existent, which is a fascinating language check when it comes to Mishnah study. So Blackman wants to make sure that he's putting them outside the bounds, and if you think about him as being a more modern translator of Mishnah and one who engages manuscripts of the Mishnah, my theory is that he wants to make it, you know, really, really bolet, that since we live among non-Jews who are generally considered Nochrim or Notzrim, that it shouldn't sound like either, and that it should really be about the ones who are like, you know, the old-time idol worshippers. And if old-time idol worshippers come and they want to, you know, help you put out a fire, well, then we can understand why you would say, you know, stay out of my house. But if it came down to your neighbor, who's just a Nochri or a Notzri, if you're only going according to his Mishnah, you wouldn't have a problem. Of course, we never go only according to the Mishnah. But it's an interesting choice of vocabulary. He obviously had around him the Vilna edition of the Gemara and could have very well, either in the text itself or in the note, said that majority of the manuscripts actually say Nochri. But he did not.
Yet, ironically, I find his English to be potentially more offensive.
Right.
Disparaging ways,
so
no concern.
That's right.
Whereas Kahati is different, not that's Kahati, but saying the way whoever is translated to Kahati, it is a nice, straightforward, objective language that's about encompassing. So.
Right, nice point, too. So what's your point? Because one says if a non-Jew.
No, I said that to me, that it may just be me, but the way Blackman's translation, Blackman actually did the translation,
yeah.
He said, you don't tell them because his abstention from labor is no concern of theirs.
Oh, no concern of theirs, that's right. Because his rest is not incumbent upon them, right. Right. If you go to the next phrase, if that's no concern of theirs versus it's not incumbent upon them. Right. So interesting how that sometimes translations go and the attitudes that they purport to maintain or don't represent. So anyway, this whole notion of what you say and what you don't say to him for the reason of either it's not incumbent or because, you know, it's of no concern. This is the issue of what you say or don't say to non-Jews on the Sabbath. There was a really interesting article that was put out recently in Tishrei of 5770 by one of the rabbis writing for Yeshiva University's collection of articles about Sukkot, and it's called Halakhic Issues Commonly Encountered During a Hotel Stay on Shabbat and Yom Tov. And it's this article, you know, when you're serious about Shabbat and being within the reality of the Sabbath and the Sabbath mode or the Yom Tov mode, and you go to a hotel and you want to actually take advantage of some of the things there, you have some really, really interesting encounters to make and really interesting kind of ways of speaking with the staff and with the folks around you to set up your Sabbath observance. And on top of that, I happen to live in a building, and God willing, you know, I should see everybody over time, please God, in my place for Shabbat. At some point, you're all invited. So, but my staff got together with me the first month I lived in the building, and they asked, because I asked them if I could teach them a little bit about the Sabbath, and they asked me to explain to them what was going on. Some people who would live in the building had not requested the meeting and met with everybody and done the training. And so here I did this training, and we have now a Sabbath protocol in the books for the building. And it's lovely. And it includes everything from how they help us open the doors without tripping the slides, to getting up in the elevator, to helping our guests, to God forbid someone needs me and someone calls the concierge on Shabbat, to come up and knock on the door and make sure that I can get to a family. And it's already happened 3 times. You know, and without that kind of cooperation. And on top of that, I just tell you that it is inspiring for this staff. And they have felt like they have been a part of something very unique and special, especially at times of death on the Shabbat. And it has been among the richest kind of experiences I've had in New York that really makes for a very, very interesting reality, Jewishly, non-Jewishly, talking about it with non-Jewish neighbors. It's very holy.
So if a Jew stays in a hotel on Shabbat and there is a fire in his room or next to the next room to his, should he alert the front desk or somebody?
You should immediately pick up your cell phone, call 911.
So
wait, you're making a bigger klutz kashya than it was.
No, but because when a nochri comes, this property is not mine, don't forget.
Nish, there's no question here. Should do everything in your power to really...
Even in biblical times?
In biblical times, they didn't have such a... In biblical times, if you were in a pundak where the property was not yours and it was the Sabbath, you probably were among those who kept the law and had other relationships with those community members, that you were not solely like a rabbinic Jew. You wouldn't, during the Sabbath, necessarily be in that place on a permanent basis. On a non-permanent basis, if you were a trader, and let's say you had to stay somewhere and you were observing the Sabbath, your responsibility for saving a life would probably override it. Already there was this ethical dimension, which we have somewhat touched upon, which we haven't entirely. You know, when it comes to Nochri, I had an interesting conversation with Shia, my son, on Shabbat. He had done as a paper for his school. Schechter asked him to look at one mitzvah and write about it, and over history to investigate the various sources and the ways that we relate to it. Okay, so he investigated Hashavat Aveda, the returning of a lost object, and what he discovered was, according to the letter of the law, you have no responsibility to return a lost object of a nochri. Here again, the term is used. Now, that might be according to the letter of the law, but also the ethical dimension of the law says, because it says kedoshim tihiyu, that you're holy people, because it says derech eretz kadma l'torah, good manners and good relations preceded Torah, because it said that mipnei darkei shalom, or mipnei tikkun olam, because for ways of peace, or for making good neighbors, right? Tikkun olam has been mistranslated in our times in a very deep way, and there's lots of good articles about that if you want that as a side note. But good neighborly moves so that there can be some peace among neighbors, or not even peace, but just a coexistence. That is really part and parcel of the law, Ron. So if I'm in a non-Jew's pundak, and I really want to make sure that everybody is safe, life is safe, property is safe, then I think that you have no question. No question.
You can do whatever you need to be done.
I really believe that there's no question.
No, I agree with that, but I mean, the way it's presented here, I wanted to see if the opposite is our obligation, like we are trying to push the Muslim not to do it.
Yeah. Again, getting us back here, what's in the rabbi's interest here is to say that we're willing to really understand what some of our approach might be in this situation. And it's not to stop us from ultimately saving life. It may be a statement about what we believe about property. I think at the end of the day, this perek is in some way responding to materialism that we could learn from. It's also, again, building that Sabbath culture. And we have now some more considerations of why the Mishnah is saying what it's going to say to discover in the Gemara. So with that, let's push into the Gemara. Parses a little bit of this out. Gives us some reason why. So Rav Ami says in the Gemara now, Amar Rabbi Ami. Rabbi Ami says the following. Badaleka hitiru lomar. In a fire situation, the sages permits one to say within earshot of nearby Gentiles, Kol amechabe eino mafsid. Anyone who extinguishes the fire will not lose out. Now, that is, according to this translation, will not go unrewarded. Right? 121a. Listen to how it's said over here. Rabbi Ami says, during a fire, the sages permit anyone to say in the presence of Gentiles, anyone who extinguishes the fire will not lose, so that the Gentiles will come and extinguish the fire. It is only prohibited to tell Gentiles to do so explicitly. Now, obviously, there is whatever this will not lose is. What is the will not lose? According to the note here, it's that they won't lose out on the reward. What's the reward? Although such a statement effectively communicates the person's wish that a malacha be performed, even though the balabait, the one whose house is burning, is in essence saying, I want you to put out the fire, and therefore transgressing the law on the Sabbath that a fire should be put out in his domicile, the rabbis did not prescribe this particular formula. In other words, they didn't make it forbidden, since he had thereby not commanded anyone to really do anything. So what does that mean? It means I have to talk like this. Well, on the Sabbath, we want you to talk like that.
But I mean, if you're in your fire around you, you're sitting there because you can't do it. Your neighbor runs in. I don't think he's going to ask you. He's going to start putting it out. You don't have to say anything, right? I mean,
Exactly. However, it's saying, don't forget that even if they do that, good neighbors will provide a reward. And some of the stories in this part of the Gemara are going to be exactly that.
But the whole focus of tell them to put it out. I don't think it's necessary unless somebody
Yeah. Well, they're, again, they're really serious about the law and about trying to keep the law. And
right, but I'm saying it doesn't seem like that would be the crux of the matter. The fire, you come in, you put it out.
Maybe.
Somebody say, oh, would you please put the fire out?
Right. Right. Let's listen to the other stories in this section and see like what some of the issues are, Carol, whether or not there was any time that they wanted to actually say don't put it out. The Gemara suggests a proof. Name Miss Ayale. Let's say that our Mishnah supports Rav Ami. No chrishabalechabot ain omrim lo kabe va'al tichabe. A Gentile comes to extinguish the fire, they may not say to him, extinguish it, nor do they tell him, do not extinguish it. Mivnei she'ein shvitato aleihem. Because his resting is not their responsibility. In other words, just not their responsibility. These folks don't have this responsibility for the balavai. Kabe hu delo amarin anlei. It is only the direct command, extinguish it, that we may not tell him. Because by doing so, we are appointing him our agent. So if I was to say to him directly, put it out, it would be as though I was willing to transgress the Sabbath law, and that is not all right. Ha! Kol amechabe eno masir amrin anle. But the implication is, we could tell him, anyone who extinguishes it will not lose, because then he'll be acting on his own accord. Especially if he's not going to lose and he's going to get rewarded. He's going to act on his own accord. He's not doing it for me. Not my transgression. It's that he has the idea of getting a reward. Gemara draws a contradictory inference from the second half of the Mishnah, meaning, Eima Seifa, but, let's consider the end of the citation, Al Techabel Lo Amrin Anle. I don't just say, put it out in the positive, we don't have to tell him, do not extinguish it. V'chol Mechabe Eino Masid Nami Lo Amrin Anle, but it is implied, anyone who extinguishes it will not lose, we may not tell him either. So if that's the case, we're not required to object and restrain him, but neither are we allowed to place an incentive before him. For such an indirect approach were permitted, why would the Mishnah not take note of it? The Mishnah should have taught, one may not say extinguish it, but one may say, anyone who extinguishes will not lose. So, problem with this kind of approach. If the Mishnah wanted to really teach that there was room to say, I'll reward you, then let the Mishnah say, I'll reward you. But it's saying, don't say to him, put it out. And don't say to them, don't put it out.
So we're allowed to say to somebody, I will reward you on Shabbat, but not allowed to tell him to do a direct function that I'm not allowed to say.
That's what it seems to be saying. That's what Rav Ami's teaching said.
So is it just, so can I play games of luck games on Shabbat?
Well, we don't apply all the time one area to another. When it comes to this malacha, this instance of this transgression, this is the situation. So we'd have to look at other principles in the way the rabbis think when it comes to games of chance. So the Gemara concludes, Eila meha leka lemishma mina. Rather, one cannot infer a proof or disproof of Rabbi Ami's ruling from this Mishnah. Now the Gemara cites a related incident, and this is the incident I'm talking about. This would be your question, Carol. Tanan Rabbana. Or Tanu Rabbanan. The rabbis teach in a brayta. There was an incident in which the courtyard of Yosef ben Simai and Shichin caught fire on the Sabbath. And the man of the Roman governor of Tzipori came to extinguish it. They were going to help him out. Why? Because Yosef ben Simai was the treasurer for the king. In other words, he was either the treasurer, par what we think of as treasurer, or he was the tax collector. And he had the monies to always pay the local governor. Right? That's how they made relationships with people, with the Jewish people. They had people who would pay them the money that was due, these outside authorities. But he didn't allow them to actually put out the fire on account of the honor of the Sabbath. So he stopped them. And then a miracle happened when he said, I'm not allowing you to do this. And a miracle occurred and rain came and put out the fire. Oh, La'erev shiger l'chol echad mehen shtei sela'im. And that night, he sent every member of the garrison two sela'im. Nice, a little bit of, you know, a nice reward. Sends them a little bit of money. V'l'iparchos shebehen chamishin. And to the lieutenant among them, he sent 50. Oh, he really gave them some dollars. U'cheshesham'u chachamim badavar. And when the sages heard of the matter, that he actually prevented the group from putting out the fire, Amru, lo hayat tzarich l'chach. He didn't need to do that. Sheharei shaninu nochri sheba l'chavod ein omrin lo kabeh va'al t'chabeh. For we have learned in the Mishnah, a Gentile comes to extinguish the fire, you don't say to him, extinguish it, nor do they have to tell him, do not extinguish it. So, who didn't need to say it? This sage, who was the treasurer, didn't need to say it all to this group. Now, if you look at the note, since the garrison acted of its own accord, he did not have to restrain them. It's pretty straightforward that they could have come in as good neighbors and put out the fire. A la what Carol was saying before. Seems like if this guy was doing right by the local governor, then his people, who were somewhat organized in helping people accomplish putting out a fire, might have been able to come in and put out the fire. But he tells them, don't put it out. A nest happens, a miracle happens. Rains come, there's no more fire. By saying, don't put it out, would he have been transgressing anything?
No. No, but we suppose not to say to people they saw it.
By saying what he did say, is he transgressing anything?
It would appear that he is.
Yeah, according to the Mishnah, he's even making a transgression. However, who rewards him? God. And he still sends this group who didn't have to put it out a reward. What's the message of the story?
Good intentions got rewarded.
Good intentions got rewarded.
The opposite of no good deed goes
unpunished. Even the opposite. What's the intention of the story in the context of a story that comes up on a Mishnah?
The author cares.
I have to raise the issue of the fact of why it just so happened that these people came to save the money. Now you're telling me he was the tax collector, so maybe there was a great deal of self-interest in them trying to put out the fire.
Oh.
So it wasn't so innocent after.
Right.
So ultimately, it's about being suspect. Ultimately, it's about being suspect is one of the ways to read this story. He suspected them of wanting to save what was in his place because of the interest of the local authority. And their interest wasn't so pure. Nonetheless, what does he do? He rewards them to show them what? Maybe you ought to do this out of your most selfless interests. Our God will always take care of us. That's the message here of the rabbis. God knows, and God will ultimately be the final arbiter. And maybe it's a teaching that the rabbi was trying to do to this non-Jewish group.
Not don't ignore the
IRS. Yeah.
Also a good teaching. We discussed in the last class that a boy has to do something in his own interest, his or her own interest, in order to do it on Shabbat and not in the interest of a Jew. Telling people that they will not lose their time if they come, they will get remunerated. So if they were coming to put out the fire because it was the tax collector's property, specifically, could they be doing it in the interest also of the tax collector?
Well, that
so that would be in the interest of a Jew, and that's why he turned them away? That they wouldn't be doing it in the interest of a Jew.
Right. So ultimately, whose interest would it have been? Could have been the Jewish interest? Absolutely. Very nice. So that's yet another read on why there's resistance to allow it to happen.
Can I ask a question about
the
temporary?
Right, but no, but can't benefit on having the fire put out then on the Sabbath. That's the exact point. So there's a reason why he had to stop them.
Yeah.
because it was ultimately in Jewish interest, and it could not be only for their own interest as the Nochrim, because the Nochrim had to do something that was truly in their own interest.
So you said before, you know, get your phone and call 911. Now today, in an observant home, and there's a fire, are you not supposed to call 911?
Yeah, you pick up your phone and you call 911.
Okay, that's not violating the Sabbath?
No. That's been completely, as we've said before, like that's been completely now for all of the property loss that could be, for the potential life loss, for the potential explosion that could happen, because our gas lines are connected to other gas lines.
So
for
the rabbis have decreed.
So decreed. Okay. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein said it in America as, you know, when 911 came, and right when all this was first coming out, there were major questions, of course, but this has now been the established way of approaching it halachically. So it doesn't. There's not only one reason or another, and this is quite an interesting take on what it said by way of whose interests are really at stake. And that's all the time, though. That's the way we're trying to figure out what our relationship is to the Nochri. Is it in our interest? Is it not in our interest? Are we breaking a Sabbath law? Are we not breaking a Sabbath law? Despite the Mishnah, why would he say such a thing? And the Gemara kind of left it there. The Gemara now goes on to the next part of the Mishnah. So we are to make meaning in this way, like the Rishonim and Acharonim did, and like we're doing here. Let's push forward. The Gemara cites the end of the Mishnah. Aval katan sheba lechabot ein shomin lo mivnei sheshvitato aleihem. A miner who comes to extinguish the fire, they may not listen to him because his resting is their responsibility. Said over here in the Steinsaltz translation, if a Jewish child comes to extinguish a fire on Shabbat, they do not listen to him and allow him to extinguish it, even though he is not yet obligated in mitzvah observance, because responsibility for his rest is incumbent upon the Jewish community. So, again, in Steinsaltz, making a little clearer about the incumbent upon who? Upon the community. The Gemara asks, Sham Atmina, shall we conclude from this ruling, Katan Ochel Nevelot, that if a minor is discovered eating Nevela meat, right, and Nevela meat in this case is the name to an animal that died without having been ritually slaughtered correctly in kosher standards. So what do we do if we find him eating such a piece of meat? Beitin Mitzuvin Alav Lahafri Show, that the court is enjoined to separate him from continuing. In other words, didn't we say that a minor is exempt from such a thing? But shall we now really take action on behalf of the community to stop this kind of practice, even if we're talking about a minor? So the Gemara goes on to explain, Dechavata gabe nofri. Now the parallel case to that one regarding the Gentile, Dekaavi ledate liYisrael, is where he's acting on behalf of the Jews' interest. Mishari? But is it permitted to allow the Gentile to extinguish the fire in such a situation? The Gemara replies, Nochri ledate denav she'avid. A Gentile always acts in his own self-interest. Either must act in his own self-interest, or is acting in his self-interest, meaning in this case for the governor, even though it was for the Jewish self-interest, one could read, by way of the rabbi understanding that, because by paying taxes we were safe. But nonetheless, what's the issue here is that the Katan, what are they saying? Shouldn't we just allow him to do it? Because he's really not obligated for the major mitzvot in the categories of Malacha and Shabbat yet. Right? And so if I allow the Nochri by not saying either put it out or don't put it out, if I allow him to come in and put out my fire, because that's the ultimate end of this, a la this either good neighborly reality or the fact that they are going to get rewarded, because the Gemara has now left this, that even though the rabbi did stop these guys in one place to really be, for whatever reason, stopping them, because maybe they weren't doing it in their own interest, or maybe they were going to get benefit as the Jewish community, either which way you do this. That was kind of like the Yotzei Dofen example. That was kind of the outside the boundary example. Because in general, I'm neither saying don't put it out or put it out, and they're going to put it out, and I'm going to give them some reward. Because the idea that they even came to the house in the story was that they were going to get something. And they got a couple svaim, the two, everybody who came on the brigade, and the lieutenant gets more. The idea here is that the miner who is coming along is, well, the Mishnah and the Gemara now is asking the question, shouldn't we just allow him to do it without telling him anything? So, A, you could say he might get hurt and therefore got to protect life. But let's say it wasn't at a time that the fire was, you know, raging and there was no real issue of getting hurt. Let's take that off the table for a second. Do I say to the miner, do I say anything? Do I say you'll be rewarded? Well, I can't say you'll be rewarded. Because I'm asking now a Jewish person to do what I'm not allowed to do. I'm not allowed to put out a fire. But do I say that he's not required to do mitzvot? And thusly, I allow him to go ahead until the time that he becomes of majority age? Well, at a certain point, I have to understand that I'm going to invoke the principle that I'm responsible for his shvut, I'm responsible for his resting on Sabbath, and the reason why I might be responsible for his resting on Sabbath is not simply because he's obligated by way of the mitzvah, it's that he has an obligation to learn how to do this mitzvah, and I have an obligation to teach that, and over time, the rabbis themselves will create a codific way of approaching the minor, and what a minor can or can't do, even though a minor is not entirely obligated in the same way as adults are obligated. So that is a long, rich history of when do I actually start educating a minor? When do I bring that minor to read the Tanakh? And when do I bring that minor to pair it to tefillin? And when does he start wearing tzitzit? And do I relate to a minor with the prohibitions of the do this kind of mitzvah and the don't do that kind of mitzvah? There's an interesting series called the Halakha series, the Jewish Law series, from Art School Publishers. We use the Art School translation of the Gemara. And this volume is called Children in Halakha. Two of the chapters are about children on Shabbat. And I want to read you the prohibitions of Shabbat. Parents are obligated to teach children of chinuch age, of educable age, to refrain from all prohibited activity on Shabbat. So once a child starts to master the ability to make, you know, to distinguish, let's say, one item that should be used on the Sabbath and one item that shouldn't, a parent should start to teach that principle to a child. So list but a few examples. One must teach children not to turn lights on or off, not to carry anything in a public domain unless there's an Eruv, not to play with mukta items, that is, even such things as pebbles that have absolutely no use to us on the Sabbath. So goes through and says, children who have not reached chinuch age are permitted to play with muktzah items. While one may neither instruct a child to play with a muktzah item, nor cause a child to do so by placing the child's hand on the item, one is permitted to put a child down in front of a muktzah item, even though the child will play with it. So what's a muktzah item? We said it's a wallet, right? Forget the fact that money is not is something we handle, but we don't handle the wallet because the wallet holds the money. We don't want a child necessarily to play with it. It's really an item that we steer clear from. But if a child's going to play with it, and the child is not of educable age, then I might not have a concern. When one may instruct a child to violate a prohibition. Some poskim rule that one is permitted to instruct a child who has not reached chinuch age to violate a rabbinic prohibition if it is to the child's own benefit. One may rely on this opinion in cases of great necessity. For example, turning on a light is considered to be a biblical prohibition, turning on a light. Why? Because it says, "Lo tzvaru eish," don't light a fire, in terms of the Sabbath law in the Torah. Thus, one is forbidden to tell a young child to turn on a light, even if the child himself will benefit from it. However, turning off a light is only rabbinically prohibited. It's derabbanan. Thus, it is permissible in a case of great necessity to instruct a child to turn off a light. Now, what is a great case? Let's say the child won't go to sleep and the light was left on. So, at that point, before the child is completely educable and it will benefit the child, you pick the child up, you say, so that's why, like, the joke is that you have a new baby constantly in a family where you're keeping the Sabbath. So, you know,
that's why they're baby.
You have a 3-year-old around.
Shabbos baby.
A Shabbos baby. Instead of having a Shabbos goy, you need to turn off the light. So,
can you turn on the dishwasher too?
No, because the dishwasher in and of itself is a whole different kind
off.
Of...
Off, not on.
So, as a matter of interest, there's a whole realm of education like this. Some of the best ones, just as a few examples of where a katan and when a katan starts to learn things. So, a katan of 6 or 7 years old can already be shown to wear a small talit katan. So when they say tzitzit, since a child's brain can say, like, oh, well, it says here to wear tzitzit, but I'm not wearing any tzitzit. Well, the child really isn't obligated to do such a thing until he's bar mitzvah. We would say, though, that earlier on it can be totally possible. So some people start to put a little talit katan. You've seen Mayona. He knows exactly what tzitzit are when he reads the Torah. And he feels very concretely connected to the fact that it says to do it in the Torah, and therefore he's doing it. And so as you see a child can really be educated in terms of the concreteness of the tradition, it only makes sense that the codes also found, and in their wisdom, they really did see this with early childhood. You think early childhood is such a new kind of reality. The rabbis were tuned in a lot to the realities of a very early childhood approach, where if something is so concrete as to be something a child could do, then we allow that child to do it, even though the mitzvah doesn't come on them later, until later. With mukta items, you know, toys that go woo-woo-woo and other kinds of things, including money, a child can understand mukta and the principle of shavur even. We have taught many families how to say to their children, not, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it. That, I believe, is a mistake that makes Shabbat like feel, like I'm doing something wrong. We teach our children, oh, that toy gets Shabbat too. And it's Shavuot. And so things get Shabbat in our world. The TV gets Shabbat. The DVD gets Shabbat. And over time, as our children came to live in community and I had the schools that I ran, this was a way that some families, they didn't think about Shabbat observance and mukta. And frankly, with the way my phones have been behaving recently, it needs more than a day off. You know, these phones are becoming more disposable now. Every little thing, if the more you use it, the faster you have to actually switch it out, because it's falling apart. That is their intention, but all the more reason why we have to rebel and say, forget it, we're going to give this a Shabbat. So anyway, that is the discussion here with Katan, and why it's so different than the Nochri. And it doesn't allow you to learn from one to the other, because they're interested in categorizing it in much different ways, or splicing the issue in much different ways.
I still have a problem, and I'll ask it again. We used to live in a mixed quarter at that time. I'm not talking nowadays. Jews and Nochri and Goy at the same time. So when a Jewish had a fire in his house, he somehow expected the Goy to come, not saying anything, and helping him to extinguish the fire. But if the next door neighbor, which is a Nochri, had a fire, we just sit down and do nothing. Because we don't talk. We are not allowing us even to extinguish a fire in our own house. So, this is one of the most important things of the Bible. So I don't know how they reconcile the whole
thing. Well, that was an answer in the Gemara, and
so that's a big problem.
That Nusach is not in
that's
the Bible.
Us
yeah, no, I hear you.
And now I know why they hate us all of this one.
A little more than that.
Just one. This is an issue for me.
Could be an issue. That's all I'll say. And you have to figure out where you're going to live then, and how you're going to live, and what you're going to do in return. And it makes for ethical considerations.
You have to yell out when the neighbor's house is on fire. You have to yell out to all the other goyim. You won't lose your time if you go.
Right. I mean,
no, I'm talking about not nowadays.
But you don't. But you know, we don't know lema'ase what happened. We know that they're building a culture. We know that they're building a culture. We know that that's generally what their hope is and expectation is. In the moment, as we've said before, human beings are human beings. Pok chaze, the Gemara says it many times. Go out and see what's really happening. So you could always say the rabbis were very aware that some of the laws would be challenged by the examples on the ground. And we don't need to pontificate about it. It's a truth. It's a truth. It's a truth that I feel coming through the text all the time when you have the rabbis relate to either outside voices other than their own, even if they're creating the voice to challenge their ruling. And it's the poke chaze, go out and see what's happening in the reality. And yet you have to create a culture somehow. You have to create a culture of law that the Sabbath represents. So that's what they're doing. Let's go to the next Mishnah. Let's at least start it. That with its Gemara. We're going to get to the second side of the page tonight, even if we don't finish it. Kofin ka'ara al gabe haner. We may invert a bowl over a lamp. Bishvil shelo te'echoz bakora, so that it won't actually catch onto the beam that's on top of the lamp, provided that one does not thereby extinguish the flame. All right, so what does that mean? You've got a lamp, and it's getting down to the bottom, and it's getting really hot, and you want to turn a bowl over it. And what's going to happen if I turn a bowl over it? Well, most likely it's going to go out. But is it going to go out the same way? Remember what happened with our goatskin? It singed the goatskin, the fire fueled it, and then it went out. Rabbi's conceptions of going out, you know, are like that, right? That you didn't really put it out, you didn't snuff it, but the fire
took the oxygen,
singed the bowl on the other side, what have you. But al tsoa shel katan, and one may invert a bowl over the feces of a child. So while we're talking about inverting bowls and kind of covering things up, we're going to stick to this. The al akrav shalotishach, and over a scorpion so that it won't sting, you can put this bowl. Now, if you look at the note, 25, Rashi explains that the bowl is an earthenware bowl. A metal bowl, however, may not be used for the purpose, since placing it over a flame would constitute a malacha of hava'ara, kindling, should the metal become heated until it glows. That's the modern ruling. The Mishnah, which permits moving the bowl to protect the beam, seems to contradict the Amora Rabbi Yitzchak, who holds that a utensil may not be moved on the Sabbath for the sake of something that may not be moved on the Sabbath, such as the beam of the house. The Gemara answers there, though, that Rabbi Yitzchak will explain our Mishnah as referring to where one wished to move the utensil for some permitted purpose, and since he's not moving the utensil in any event, he may tailor its movement for the sake of the beam, which may not be moved. Okay, so issues there. And Rashi says that is one must cover the lamp in such a way that the air supply is not completely cut off. That way we kind of said you use the oxygen. Okay. Now, what's the issue with some of these things? The issue is that we are worried about transgressing Malachot Shabbat. The issue is that we're worried about doing a work or work in the category of a major no-no on the Sabbath. The 39 Avot Melacha, the 39 major categories of work. We looked at the Mishnah previously about that had those 39. Those who were here that evening saw there are 39 major categories. One of them happens to be what? Putting out a fire. One of them happens to be trapping. So can I trap this scorpion? This will become an issue for the Gemara. We'll hear all about now you know, bugs, bites, and all kinds of crazy insects. Really interesting part of the Gemara coming up. Entomology in that time, an interesting topic in and of itself about what they knew and what they didn't know by way of these kinds of deadly bugs or bugs that were potentially harmful, and also bugs that they ate. Just we get into the issues, might as well mention, they were not mentioned on the list of food items that were the delight of the Sabbath. Though, in the ancient world, they might have eaten some forms of hagavim, for sure, of grasshoppers, because the bugs that are permitted have the four legs, with two for walking, two for run, you know, four for running, and two, you know, of the kind of leaping legs, like what we consider to be those grasshopper-looking. Six or eight categories of those that are permissible, and there are different markings, and they're very, very particular about what they allow in terms of eating those. These are, though, not edible bugs. These are stinging and very kind of dangerous and even venomous bugs. Okay. Rabbi, what does Rabbi Yehuda, though, say in the Mishnah? Amar Rabbi Yehuda, Ma'aseh Baal Disnei Rabban Yochanan Ben Zakkai Ba'arav. Here's an incident of a person who inverted a bowl over a scorpion on the Sabbath, and he came before Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai in the Galilean city of Arav. Interesting that the Mishnah should, by the way, have like a nice Ma'aseh story, and we don't have many, many of those in the Mishnah, but we do have some. Right? We do have some. It is a part of the Mishnaic corpus, but here we have a story, and it says about Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai that really, they only came with a couple of questions in his lifetime when he lived in Arab, and he was very, very angry by that. Oh, they don't pay attention to Torah here, and they don't pay enough attention to Torah here, and they're all going to become farmers, and this is not a great kind of Torah community. He kind of expressed his discontent. Anyway, this is one of those times. V'amar hosh'ani lo mechatat. And he said, I fear for him that he is liable for a chatat, meaning for transgressing the malacha, the categorical labor of trapping, which is not permissible on the Sabbath. Okay, so you have that opinion of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai at the end of the Mishnah, that this scorpion thing really worries him. The Gemara now is going to go forward with another incident where the Mishnah is discussed, explained. Rav Yehuda, Rav Yirmiyah, Bar Abba, Rav Han, Bar Rava, Ikla, Alave, Avin, Demi, Neshikya. Rav Yehuda and Rav Yirmiyah, Bar Abba, and Rav Han, Bar Rava visited the home of Avin from Neshikya. Rav Yehuda, Rav Yirmiyah, Bar Abba, for Rav Yehuda and Rav Yirmiyah, Bar Abba, made it to the second side. Aitu Lahu Puryata. They brought couches on which to recline. L'Rav Hanan bar Rava lo aitule, but for Rav Hanan bar Rava they didn't bring a couch, but sat him instead on the ground. Ashkeche matne le'levre. In the course of the visit, Rav Hanan bar Rava found Rav Avin teaching our Mishnah to his son as follows. So here was a time when the oral tradition comes into clear focus for us, and the textual tradition is going to be visited within the next passage of the Gemara as to how the texts are taught, what texts are extant, what texts are not extant. And he says, V'al tsoa shel katan mipnei katan. And one may invert a bowl over the feces of a child because of the child. I.e., so that the child should not handle it and become soiled. Amar le, Rav Hanan bar Rava said to Rav Avin, Avin shtaya matnei shetuta levnei. Avin the fool teaches foolishness to his son. V'halo, he atzma muchenet lechlavim. Why, the reference cannot be to feces excreted by the child, as you explain it. For that very excrement is itself considered prepared for the consumption of dogs, because the dogs at that time, I guess they would see the dogs as nibbling at the feces, the human feces. And thus it's not mux at all to be moved away, because you can't have that kind of feeding of the animals, or any kind of thing that would lead to the animals coming in and eating that. The chetem of alochazia le'netmo. And perhaps you'll say it's in defense of your explanation that the child's excrement is mux because it was not fit for the dog from yesterday. In other words, you're going to give me this argument that it was a kind of new food for the dogs, fit for the dogs, and therefore you couldn't move it because it really hadn't come into reality yesterday or been started yesterday, and the only thing I could touch was something that was already in process. right? Like Hillel said about something, you started the dying process back before Shabbat and it could end on the Sabbath. Something like this, where now the end here was that you had the feces and then the feces could be moved because it had started from yesterday. That's all of that. I don't need to hear from you. There's no argument here. V'hat Tanya, why this is not the law, for it's been taught in a braita. Here's a braita that I have regarding this issue. Naharot ha-moshchin umayinot ha-novin hare hen karagle choladan. Waters from flowing streams and gushing springs are permitted to be transported like the feet of any person who happens to carry them at the moment. In any event, we see from the braita that what? Anything that was traveling from upstream, downstream, that was going to be then drawn out and used to drink today, that's fine, I can handle it, because it was in the natural process and order of things to actually come about to be here today. So anything that's in natural process and order that is going to happen within the feces is obviously going with excreting anything from your body is going to be just as natural as anything from a river upstream. And therefore, there's no issue with handling these things. So I don't really get what's going on. But what should the mishvela hechi atnaye? But here's really what should be taught. It's not about this whole issue even. I'm giving you that you might have thought all these things. What's the real teaching about? Ema al soa shel tana golim ifnei katan. Say that the Mishnah means to say that one may invert a bowl over the feces of chickens because of the child. So that the child shouldn't handle it and become soiled. Chicken feces, everybody agrees, are all mukta. You can't touch them. Because not even a dog would eat them. Charlie, you should go into the bowl making business. Okay, so he says, the Gemara asks, but table glaze the havi garaf shalrai. But even if the Tana is referring to chicken excrement, which is mukta, let it emerge to him, or let it come to his mind that one's permitted to move it away because it's tantamount to a vessel of excrement, whose clearing away the rabbi's permitted, though the excrement is mukta because it's repulsive. V'chi tema garaf shalrai agav manaein. And perhaps you'll say that in the case of a vessel of excrement, where the mukta excrement is being moved indirectly through the movement of the vessel that it contains, yes, they permitted it. Ihu gufe lo, but the excrement itself, no. So the vessel would work, but the excrement itself, you shouldn't touch. Meanwhile, v'ha'hu achbar de ishtakach be'is paramaki de Rav Ashi. But there was a mouse that was found among the spices of Rav Ashi one time. And what happened with that? V'amar lahu nekotu betzutzete v'apuka. He took hold of it by its tail, and he removed it. Proving what? Something so disgusting is right in the middle of your spices, and you can remove that. Something so disgusting that's in the middle of your living quarters, of course you're going to get rid of. So I have no issue with mukta. And the Gemara answers, Ba'ashpa, the Mishnah refers to chicken feces that are in a trash pile. Since they're not lying in a populated area that people should be repulsed by them, what? Then I can't move them. So if I go out within my couple of whatever, Tachum Shabbat, my area of Shabbat, and I'm walking around and I get to the trash heap, which generally isn't in a populated area, I shouldn't, clear a space for everybody to play. That's where the Gemara gets to. The Katan Ba'ashba, my barley. But what's a child doing in the environs of a trash heap? What are you doing there to begin with? The Mishnah should have to state that one may cover the feces so that the child not become soiled. Amar answers, Bachatzer, the Mishnah means that the feces are lying in a courtyard. Oh, but wait a minute, it could be that we're really talking about the feces lying in a courtyard. Hatzin amigraf shel raihu, but excrement in the courtyard is also a case of a vessel of excrement, since it's lying where people are present and will be repulsed by it. And the Gemara explains, Be'ashba v'shebachatzer, what we mean is that the feces lie in a trash heap that's in the courtyard. Feces may not be moved because they're in a trash pile, yet, what?
You
can use one of the bowls. Okay.
This must have been like a problem all the time.
It must have been.
It must have been, yeah.
And so what did they need here? What's the point in this piece of the what's the point in this piece of the Mishnah and the Gemara? In order to make your Shabbos pleasant enough, let us give you the system of how you're going to cover these things, and you won't transgress any major categories of law. And we're going to tell it to you a little bit like this and like that within our Gemara system, so that you feel as though, and you know, that you're not transgressing any law. important for the rabbis, and now we get to the trapping issue.
Wait a minute, what about the opinion of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai? He said he may be obligated for a
chassad. Oh, that's good, because that's going to come up soon with the trapping issue. And that's where we're going next. Because Yochanan ben Zakkai, remember, is talking about the chatas after you trap the scorpion.
The scorpion.
Now, we get to the whole section here about the bugs.
Was he only talking about the scorpion?
Yeah, he was really addressing that ma'aseh, that instance where a person inverted a bowl over a scorpion on the Sabbath. So, we'll just read the first braita, since we're at the ending time for today. We'll start here the next time about our bugs. The braita says the following, Rav Yosef, okay, Va'al akrav shalot tishach, and over a scorpion so that it won't sting. We put the bowl, right? We trapped it. Amar Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi. Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi says the following. Kol hamazikin neharagin b'shabbat. Any lethal creature may be killed on the Sabbath. Now, one has to know that killing a living creature l'chatchila is not permitted. So, this statement to say that one may indeed kill this is a kind of radical move. Killing a living creature on the Sabbath constitutes the malacha of shochet, of slaughtering. And that's why we say one shouldn't do it. Now, if I say about killing a bee or a wasp or something like this that it's shechita, where do we regularly know shechita from? Shechita, when we want to have a kosher something to eat.
Park East.
Right? Park East. They're not over there, you know, catching little bugs and pulling out the shechita knife. Right?
We are not.
Nonetheless, I put into the same category of shechita, I put the killing of a living creature. Even a living creature, perhaps, that is harmful. This gets into a whole halachic debate, this example, along with others in other categories of the law, says, what about though if I have a malacha she'en tzricha legufa? What if I have a category of work where I commit a transgression regarding a major category of Sabbath work that does not exactly parallel the original categorical definition of the malacha, of the category. In other words, if I say that killing an insect is shechita, but it doesn't match up with the lawmaker's original intent that shechita was to kill a kosher animal, either for its hide to use among the tabernacle, or to write a sefer Torah, or to use the meat of that kosher animal so that I could eat the kosher parts thereof, can I really do that? So, in halachic parlance, a malacha she'en tzricha legufa, might I be able to light a fire that wasn't for the smelting of metals that I needed to make holy implements in the Mishkan? What if I light a fire for some other purpose? A la lighting my engine and driving in my car. And so, some of the more modern application of malacha she'en tzricha legufa, of a category of work or transgressing a category of work that does not then parallel the same type of transgression that I might have made if I did this work back in the time that the Mishkan was being made, or in the community of Sabbath goers in the time of the Mishnah, can't I still do that? So, if I kill the bug that's harmful, is it really the same as going out and slaughtering cow for meat? So this is where the rabbis oftentimes will say that you can only push such a principle so far, that we still do define shechita as the killing of living creatures, that the killing of living creatures is at the core of the matter anyhow. Remember, I told you that the 39 categories of work on one level are connected to the work going on in the Mishkan, in the tabernacle, but that's not their entire outlook. That is a very, very one-sided or non-multivalent look at why the rabbis, or how the rabbis created the 39 major categories of work for the Sabbath, and how they built the Sabbath culture. So Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi is saying that all lethal creatures may be killed on the Sabbath, kind of in realization that he's got this category of work to be debating. Is it really shechita, even if the creature is lethal? Am I transgressing a major category of Sabbath work if I allow this? And so the discussion that's going to ensue is going to have some of that in the background, in the backdrop, as we pursue this question about whether or not it is legal to kill a lethal insect. And we're going to hear about some of the particular matters that come about for people who are interested in saving all species kind of approach to the environmental questions, which are embedded within this conversation of the Gemara on 121 side B. And there's also going to be some, of course, practical application of the law, or of making distinctions in the law that allow, of course, for our practices to include anything that's going to protect life at the court. On to it the next time. The very week of Passover, we're not going to have class. But we have class, wait, next week.